You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. This is The Comedian's Comedian. And it's a good title for a podcast, this one, because this is Ed Axel, described by The Guardian as Britain's greatest living anti-comedian. And I've described him to other guests on this show in the past as being like Tommy Cooper, but for jokes. In the same way that Tommy Cooper would, he was a magician whose magic would deliberately go wrong and seem out of control, even though he knew what he was doing. Ed, I've always said, is similar, but for the art of telling jokes and performing stand-up comedy. He appears not to know what he's doing. He knows exactly what he's doing. It's absolutely breathtaking and not always the easiest to get into. And I have been to shows that Ed's done where you can see that some people are not understanding the finesse. They're not familiar enough with the codes and conventions of comedy that he is playing with. But then at the same time, there is a strong clowning element to what he does. We're going to talk about all of these things and indeed how he is even more reliable in his absurdity these days. And we're going to talk about all of that in just a moment. Quick reminder, there's extra material available from this episode at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. That said, this is Ed Axel. Let's talk a little bit about the kind of furrow that you're ploughing.
Oh, fuck yeah. I wouldn't say it's much of a furrow, but yeah, I mean...
You're unlike anyone else.
Yes, yes. So there are a group of comedians, all of which can be described as mavericks, can't they? Really, ultimately. And I mean, sort of Trevor Locke and Paul Foote and, you know, Munnery and people like that. They're all doing something that's unique and different. And
for people outside the UK, I imagine people like Neil Hamburger, yeah. Norm Macdonald.
Yeah.
A small but recognisable sect.
Yeah, oddballs. And I'm hopefully somewhere on the outside of that oddball sect.
Yeah, gotcha. Okay.
More oddball, but I'm an oddball, you know.
Yeah, and you're an oddball amongst oddballs because you, even within that group, there are certain things that you do very differently. Like, I can't think of anyone. I can't think of anyone who has your sort of pace, your sort of... whatever the opposite of dynamism is, you know. I can't think of anyone that's exploring that territory with the commitment that you do.
Yeah, exploring the territory in a very uncommercial way.
How can I possibly not make money at this?
I don't know. I mean, it's tricky. You know, There are, yeah. I'm exploring a very... I've got myself into a groove which is highly unique and very, very distinct from everybody else. Yeah. Anti-comedy. So bad it's good. That's the aim of... You know, it's got to go wrong. It's got to go wrong. It's got to be slow. It's got to be rambling. It's got to, you know... I do think it's sharp as well. I do think there's some sharp ideas there, but it badly executed, you know, is the aim.
You've just reminded me, I used to describe you to people. I'm quite evangelical about your work.
Right, right.
I feel we started at a sort of similar time.
We bumped into each other on that period of the circuit.
And I think there are certain things that I I'm very drawn to. I've never seen anyone split a room like you.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
I remember being in the underbelly whenever you played. It was one of the arch-shaped rooms.
Yeah.
Quite a wide room. I don't remember the name of it. And the audience was down the middle, killing ourselves laughing, and just angry to the verge of shouting about how much they hated and didn't understand it.
I
feel like the way I used to describe you to people was he's like Tommy Cooper, but for jokes instead of magic.
Yeah. Someone said I was a verbal clown. So it was.
Yes.
I think that was James Kettle. That it was clowning, but it was verbally. Anyway,
yeah, so instead of kind of making, like, the things that I associate with, inverted commas, clowning in the kind of contemporary, the way clowning is done these days, it's sort of like, it's very sort of physical. If you think of Dr. Brown kind of making those kind of impulses and doing stuff. Yeah. I'm miming here. There's a lot of sort of physical stuff, whereas you are very, very antithetical to that, but still clowning. It's almost like the offers you're making are... quotes about Wittgenstein just sort of refusing to make eye contact with us. It's really not just the absence of those things, but the opposite of those sort of physical things.
Absolutely. And I wouldn't say... I mean, there's... the way I started the act, I mean, there was no grand plan or anything. It was not... You know, the way I started it was... That's what it was. It was just a series of ideas and me standing there, take it or leave it. And that was who I was. And over a period of time, it's developed, I think. But ultimately, at the core of it's me. You know, that's the way I am. You know, I'm not particularly energetic. I do think about sort of big ideas quite a lot, but not very successfully. So, you know, ultimately that to a certain extent is an extension of me. It's not as much of an act as it looks, I think, sometimes. Sometimes it's more me than, you know, sometimes the work. And the difficulty is as a comedian, you get very stuck in your ways as well. Do you find that? You're stuck in a group of, you know, a particular way of telling a joke, a particular way of doing things. And it's become, because I've done so much, I've got a group of things that work, you know, a series of ideas that tend to work, dependent on the day, obviously. But Edinburgh and places like that are good for me, and festivals like MacFest and all of those places are good because they kind of are happy to embrace the different, I think.
You mean the audience?
Yeah. Yes. Audiences are happier, much more happier to see something that's at an angle or slightly abstract. And that's kind of where my home is, really, I think. I remember doing the BBC. I, I, I still believe I totally fluked all of that. You know, I completely fluked it. I did. In fact, you know, one of the semis, no, the quarterfinal. I said, well, I'll do the to myself. I said, I'll do the gig, and then I'll just give up. You know, that'd be my last gig. So can't be bothered with this. And something.
Which aspect of it could you not be bothered with? How do you mean?
I was too lazy. I was working in an office. You know, who gives a shit? Somehow I got through the quarterfinal, and then I got through to the semi-final, and then I got to the final. But the people in the final, obviously, you know, of the oddballs, I suppose, is me and John Luke Roberts were in the final. But the person who came first was Tom Allen.
Mm.
And
this is the BBC one?
Yeah.
It was in Cardiff.
No, it wasn't. No, it was in the Comedy Store in...
Okay, which one am I thinking of? Because I did one with Tom Allen that he won.
He won everything, didn't he? Yeah. Yeah. And he won So You Think You're Funny as well.
Yeah.
So Tom Allen won the BBC, the final of the BBC, and Sarah Millican came second, and I came second as well.
Yes, yes, okay.
And I must have fluked that. I mean, you know, I don't know how I did that. I did, you know.
Well, I think you were very, very funny. I remember that time. You were very, very funny. And also, you were 100% different to everyone else on the bill.
Yes.
You weren't presumably walking around backstage thinking, oh, I hope no one does anything on
stage. No, I wasn't worried. I wasn't worried anybody was going to do that. I remember... And I don't know whether it makes a big difference, and I think it probably does, is anxiety before you go on stage. In those days, the level of anxiety before I went on was so great that I think it actually helped me in a big way because of the adrenaline, the nerves that... Because I was literally forcing myself to stand on that stage, you know, and the nerves, and I think that made a big, big difference. Because you never, because what's bizarre about those kind of that kind of era of that I was in? I mean, I literally there were some gigs that I was so different, I suppose, that I could pull the roof off a room, you know, as an open spot. I would be the standout act of an evening, you know. And I think part of it, you know, I think part of it was, A, I was doing something that was completely different, and B, the nerves that I was, you know, that must have made some sort of difference. Do you think that when I mean, this is the problem, is the longer you go on in stand-up, the less nerves you have? Do you find... Well, it varies. And I actually prefer going on stage now and having no nerves. I actually prefer, if I've got a gig in the diary that day, I prefer actually only thinking about the gig about 10 minutes before I go on stage. Yeah. That's what I prefer.
Yeah, the best gig is if someone rings you up and you're on the road and you're having a night off and they go, could you just pop in and do this? It hasn't ruined my day.
yeah, absolutely. And not thinking about it, just not thinking about it.
I think there are two types of... There's kind of positive nerves when something's really important and you're excited about it.
Yeah.
And then there's a really positive total lack of nerves where you're playing your favourite room, you've killed it 100 times there, and it's like stepping into a warm bath.
Yeah.
So you don't feel anything negative about it. It gives you enormous freedom.
Yeah.
But I want to ask why you were... If you look at... Because I think you did a course, did you? Is that how you...
Yeah,
you
I did started? The Amuse Moose.
I want to know why you were moved to do that. If you were in a position where you had a day job and you were suffering terribly from nerves, why did you want to keep going?
So,
you kind of draw. What was it that you were drawn to?
Okay, so I was working in a boring job, which was quite well paid at that point in time and was quite interesting.
A boring job that was quite interesting.
Well, yeah, you know, it went through phases. So, you know, so there were no real issues. The the reality was that I wanted to do something that was different. And I read something in the paper about this course. And I think it was Shazia Mirza, who'd worked as a civil servant and then done this course. It was one of those sort of Christmas things that you read in the Telegraph. You know, you're sitting at your parents' house reading the Telegraph, bored stuff. And I thought, that's a good idea. And I just emailed them. Hill's Jago. But I just emailed them saying, yeah, I'd like to do it. You know, what's the harm? What's the risk? And I did the course, and as a consequence, there was the Jimmy Carr DVD.
Yes. Comedy Idol.
Yeah.
Well, that was, so tell me about that. Before we get to that, what part in the kind of timing of that? You did the course. I want to talk to you about the course and how you brought yourself to it. That was before, though.
So I brought myself to the course principally because it was something interesting and it was something different. I didn't bring myself to do it because I hadn't been to a comedy gig for 10 years, 15 years. I'd been seeing a bit of comedy at university. That's about it.
And your first gig there, did that become, like, I think of the first few years of you with subject lines written on your hand in biro that you'd go, now we're going to talk about the Pope, now we're going to talk about the Spanish Armada. Was that what you were doing from the off?
No.
Did you experiment with different things as part of the course? Because what you ended up with is something so innately you and so different. Yeah. I'm interested in whether there were missteps along the way where you were trying to be something else.
No. This is where, you know, so I found the course quite abstract, actually. It was really odd in the sense that I kind of got out of the, we did the course and I don't quite know what, I never quite understood what the course was about, because it was quite abstract and there were gentle lessons on learning, on how to perform and what to, you know, but they were gentle, you know. So you got to the end of the course and you were sort of in Mafeking territory. You've got to come up with something and go on stage in 10 minutes. So, you know, that's what I did. I came up with something very quickly and went on stage. The interesting thing is if you go to the Jimmy Carr DVD, which was four gigs in.
And that's available on you. I've rewatched that recently.
Yeah. That was four gigs in. You go to the rehearsal, the audition bit. I was literally throwing myself at the door. I was literally going, think of something in your own head and just go and do it. Which I did. That's exactly what I did.
And just to explain what that was a sort of a DVD extra for a Jimmy Carr.
But you had to have this audition. You have to have this audition. What am I going to say? We spent all day in this sort of club. I don't know what it was. It was this. There was about 150 of us in that club for this audition. There were hundreds and hundreds of people. And you had about 3 minutes in front of Jimmy Carr. And I went because we all got an email saying it was happening. Why not go? And I went because it was a day out. Why not? And then, you know, you wait around most of the day and suddenly you've got to go on. What are you going to say? No idea. Just so popped in my head. Go and do it. That was it. See what happens.
That's nuts because it doesn't.
Yeah, it was nuts.
Watching it, it seems like it's a set. It seems like it's a set you've worked on because it's got timing and rhythm and pauses and that thing that you do where you appear to be trapped in the circumstances. I was winging it.
I was just totally winging it. And that was the thing. Over a period of that year until the end of the BBC, where the final of the BBC, I was winging it every time. And by then, by the time I'd got to the BBC, it was more of an act. It was an act, just about. But effectively, I was winging it. And this is the bizarre thing about that period, was because it was such a sort of high-risk strategy, it could have gone either way. And it could have ended at the Jimmy Carr thing. They could have said, that's just rubbish. That was the most likely outcome. That's just rubbish, you know. You know, stick at the day job type attitude. And if they had, I'd have walked away and stuck at the day job. You know, I wasn't determined. You know, there was no, I had no need to do it, you know, except enjoyment. You know, I was doing it for kicks, really, you know. And then I did the same, you know, the BBC. If I hadn't come runner off or I hadn't gotten to the final, I could easily have just walked away. You know, it was just a bit of a laugh. So that, in terms of me continuing in comedy, that was my, A, have fun, and B, ride the wave. Just ride the wave as long as it, and what was bizarre is the wave seemed to be somewhere it's going in my direction, and I just carried on. And I did Edinburgh the following year, and that was a big, big success. And then, you know, carried on for 3-4 years, and it, you know, really, there was a lot of work that went into the Edinburgh shows, but the first show, no work went into it at all. What are you going to do? Well, I've got 30 minutes at the Edinburgh City Football Club, you know.
That is a venue I've not heard of.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
In 25
I know.
Years.
Yeah, I know. It was the Edinburgh City Football Club, which is on in Leith. Okay. Free festival.
Yeah.
And it was at 12:20 or something. Basically, if you were gonna get the least, you know, the probably the worst spot in Edinburgh, that's got to be on the list. But it was amazing. Started slow. Kate Copstick came to the first one with two other people. we winged it every day. Me, John Smith and Matt Brown. You know, we just mucked around every day. And by the end of it, you know, Jimmy Carr said on the Culture Show, on the last weekend, that was the funniest thing you'd seen on the Fringe. You know, this was the bizarre thing about those days, was suddenly people were... They thought it was amazing. None of us knew what it was.
So this is Ed. It's such a joy to talk to him, and he really is a fusion of clowning and stand-up. It's such a pleasure to watch someone forging their own territory. He's described, well, I call him in the show notes for this, an oddball amongst oddballs. If you'd like to go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders, then you can get hold of some extra material, including Ed, on the context of the oddball act, the context of oddball comedy, in fact, as well as a recap of the clown course led by Dr. Brown, Phil Burgers, who I did an episode with many years ago, very influential figure in comedy in Britain and all over the world. Ed and I found themselves on one of Dr. Brown's clown courses together, and we discussed that a little bit. Worth listening if you're an insider or would like to support the show with a regular donation and become an insider. comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, T-shirts are nearly there. People, I can tell T-shirts are nearly there because it's that time of year when people start emailing me and commenting in the Comedians Comedian Facebook group saying, so have they been posted yet? No, they get posted on the 1st of February. That was always the plan. That's what it said on the merch page. but I suspect you're unable now to check because I've altered what it said on there broadly to say they're sold out. I haven't gone back to it now to check whether or not it does make that explicit. I'm sure it does, and if it doesn't currently, it did once. You've just got to trust me. You will get them within February, I promise. Now, a little bit more. I think I said now twice there, but leave it in. We haven't got time to cock about. Book now, remember, for some live podcasts. There is going to be the 2nd of February at Vault Festival. It's a Saturday, 2nd of February, 4:30 p.m. I am interviewing police cops, otherwise known as the Pretend Men. They have taken Edinburgh by storm in the last few years, doing amazing three-hand, very sweaty, acrobatic, very, very funny, high-speed costume change, sight gag, verbal gag stuff. They're kind of like a really frantic pyjama men, and there's three of them, and they're a bit different. So if you're fans of that kind of stuff, get along and see them at the Vault Festival in London. I believe they're on the January the 31st and February the 1st at 10:45 at the Vault Festival, and then come along on February the 2nd at 4:30 p.m. for that one. You can find the link to those sales pages in the show notes. Also, on March the 23rd at 1 p.m, as part of the Birmingham Podcast Festival, there is a live special ComCom Pod with a big guest, as yet unannounced. So jump on that and show me, prove to me your loyalty, my loyal ComCom fans, by just taking a punt on that and booking tickets for it before I even tell you who it is. Read between the lines as much as you like there. Right, that's all of that. Email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you would like to get in touch to suggest anything about the podcast. The postamble is going to be very quick at the end of this one because I have bags and bags to do. The year is gearing up and lots of things are happening. I will tell you all about some gigs at the weekend. That's all for the postamble. And of course, my own tour, comedianscomedian.com/tour. I'm gearing up, ready for the first leg, the tour, the mini tour that's taking place in spring. I think we start at the end of February. And also at the end of the show, some exciting news about the Edinburgh Festival. Now it's back to Ed Axel.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Talk to me about your relationship with the stuff that you do and whether you know when it's working. Like, do you understand, like, when you're lifting the roof off a club as an open spot, did you know why?
No.
Really?
Not really. And this is the interesting thing, is... And this is the interesting thing about some gigs that you do. You know, there are gigs that you lift the roof off on these days, and you kind of reconcile in your head. It's a combination of things that, you know, you roll the dice and they're all in your favour.
Like what sorts of things?
Great audience, you know, a bit of tension in the room. You know, all of those kinds of things these days, you're on the right spot in the bill, all of those kinds of things, you kind of know now what it is that, you know, allowed you to pull the roof off, and also why the next day you do another gig as flat. You kind of know the distinction. But in those days, I didn't know the distinction. I didn't understand the distinction.
So what? So you were going into battle, as it were, with like you're stepping out on stage, possibly very nervous.
Yeah.
And what is it? Because I know there will be people listening to this who haven't seen you, and we're sort of half describing what it is that you do.
Yeah,
you,
yeah.
You kind of.
I was blind in those days, completely blind, no idea, and I was conscious that you've got to make people laugh. That was the key to it. Just make people laugh. Just clown around and make people laugh. Do whatever you can, and that's what I did.
And that's interesting because to me that kind of. It's like you're not up there to say something meaningful. Some comics, you see them, it's always like the audience laughing is secondary to them making their point, for example. Yeah. You're a really interesting combination of those different elements of comedy, because if you are like a clown, I mean, that's a pure clowning thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do whatever it takes to make them laugh, most often, most commonly, physically. But at the same time, you're not kind of, you're not kowtowing to them at all. You're not going to change what you do in order to make them laugh. Do you see what I mean? That's a really unusual thing.
Yeah.
It's like, I'll do anything I can to make you laugh within a very specific set of things that I'm absolutely not going to budge from.
Yeah.
So you would, what's the first bit that you remember thinking...
Well, that's how I taught myself. I mean, this is the problem, really, when it gets down to it, is with me, stand-up was completely self-taught. And in some ways, that's what I love about it, and that's what I still love about it, is that it's all about you, you know, in the sense that you do what... You're free, you know... You decide what you're going to say. No one else does. You create your own thing. And there's no other art form where there's that much freedom, really. I mean, it's just, you know, all you got to do is make him laugh. And that's it.
Yeah, and other than that, sort of, it is whatever you say it is.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you create your own thing. You create your own world, and stand up is unique in that. It's just you and a microphone, and that's it. You and microphone and audience. You've got a blank canvas.
I think it's interesting that certainly all stand ups create our own worlds.
Yeah.
But most of us choose to do so in a way that is not too dissimilar from the world created to the person next. It's like, here's my take on the world. And for a lot of comics, our take on the world is something that must be relatable to everyone, to the audience's understanding of the world.
Yeah,
it's almost like you're going, not only am I going to do my take on the world, but it's as different from regular stand-up as a painter is from a novelist.
Yeah.
And I'm just because you're bringing yourself to this, or you did in the past as a kind of regular day jobbing marketing office job person. I'm wondering where the intestinal fortitude came from to keep going on the times when it didn't work.
Okay. So the big advantage. So I had that dreamlike first year. You know. I had it was an absolute dream that first year. It couldn't have gone better. So, first few gigs, then Jimmy Carr DVD, a real shot in the arm, getting into the final of the Jimmy Carr DVD, storm that gig, great feeling, Comedy Store, then somehow getting into the final of the BBC, and... coming runner up, and then they gave me a prize, you know, all of that sort of stuff, £1,000. They gave me a car, and they drove me, all of those kind of things. Just that after the first year, and following that after Edinburgh, when I first went up. The feeling that I was onto something was there, and I think if I hadn't had that encouragement I wouldn't stop at it.
Yeah, it's kind of like a macro version of when a lot of comics start, their first gig is incredible, then the next 10 are incredibly tough.
But
that first one keeps you going. Like, you had a year's worth of incredible first gigs almost.
And that really encouraged me to just keep on keeping on. It's a long, hard road. And, there are lots of kind of wasted journeys and three people in a pub in Droitwich, that you do for your art, really. But, you get through those. Because I felt genuinely there was something there. There was something worth having there, which is why, I've sort of kept going, really. Because every now and again you realize how much fun it is. But now it's more fun than I wouldn't say now do my current act, and I don't know, it may change for Edinburgh this year, but it's easy, a lot easier than it was. Do you find that it's easier now than it was?
Yes.
And no, obviously.
Yes and no, yeah.
Because you see, this is the bizarre thing, is it's a yes and no, because I still die. I still have gigs where I die flat on my arse and I feel like an idiot. But more and more, that doesn't happen. And if it does happen, I don't care so much. I'm annoyed. I spend the next day going, I then blame the audience or blame the promoter or blame, Brexit or something. And I move on. Also, the highs are lower, I find.
The highs are lower.
I can storm a gig now. I can really, really storm a gig and walk away and forget it.
Dissipates faster, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Like any drug.
Yeah. It means less, far, far less. Chirpier the next day, I told you I was good type thing. But really, 2 days later, it's gone. And this is the funny thing about live comedy. The immediacy about it is because it's live, it's over. Everybody got up the following day, went to work. They're not thinking about anything. it's a moment in time that no longer exists. It was just a moment in time. I find that is...
maddening.
I find it harder... In the sense that, you can have great, great gigs and almost in the scheme of things, it's meaningless. It doesn't change anything. Particularly tour gigs, actually. You do a great tour gig in, I'm trying to think, but you do,
let's say Lincoln.
Lincoln or something. It's a room. There's probably about 40 people there. You saw me. You have a great gig. You enjoy it. Everybody loves you at the end. You love them, and all of that sort of stuff. It might as well not have happened. There's no value to it. There's almost
Do you think that would be different if there were 10 times more people there?
I don't know. Possibly. I'm not 100% sure whether I would. No, I don't think it would make any difference at all.
Because the thing happens, it finishes, and that's that. Yeah, and that's what's good over. About it, and that's what's bad
yeah,
about it.
It's over. It's over. It's over. Yeah. They paid a fiver to see you or a tenner to see you. that's the transaction. It's done. Yeah.
Is there anything you could say to Ed Axel of 10 years ago to improve what he was doing
now.
Faster? Yeah. Is there anything you now could say? Could you, like, in terms of the lessons you've learned along those
three, well, I was hoping the other way around, that Ed Axel 10 years ago would tell me how to improve things now. but no, it was a journey. It was an adventure. I mean, that was the great thing about it in those days. It was an adventure, and it was instinctive. Anything that was funny was instinctive. So it was instinctively funny. It wasn't, you know, I was using everything in my armory to get a laugh. Everything.
And that, is that different from now?
Yes, it's a lot different from now in the sense that now I'm sort of looking for a rhythm or trying to be cheeky or dealing with the... I didn't like dealing with the audience. That's something that takes or took me a number of years.
To find a way for you to deal with them in keeping with how you are on
keeping
stage.
With the act, and also, yeah, it sort of breaking the fourth wall and making them just as much a part of the gig as I am, you know. Audience participation, I like now. You know, I do a lot more of that.
You've got a bit about asking what broadband provider.
Yeah, yeah, or something like that. You know, just messing with people, just mucking around. That took a longer than... I find it a lot easier to do that now. So stuff like those kinds of things are less... I've got less anxiety about, you know.
So tell me what anti-comedy means to you. I don't know, do you describe yourself as an anti-comedian, or is that just something that other people...
I think I probably am an anti-comedian in the sense that it's so bad it's good, I think.
And what are the rules to that? Just if you look at the idea of interacting with an audience, like, it's easy for a jolly comedian to chat to a person in the crowd because it's in keeping with his persona. He's going to talk to them in the audience, find out something about them and make a joke about it. Now, for you, as someone who doesn't make jokes about things so much as you sort of set up the circumstances under which we might expect there to be a joke any minute.
Yeah, yeah.
And then kind of... blithely ignore those circumstances. I'm not even quite sure what it is. So I suppose my line of questioning is, it must be harder to establish those circumstances with a fellow player, with someone in the audience who you're talking to. And what that makes me think is, well, what are those circumstances? What is it? What is anti-comedy that you do? What is it? Is it about setting up the expectation of a joke and then denying it?
I don't know. It's about creating tension, I think, you know, ultimately. But anti-comedy, you know, what you do is you create the tension in the room in a slightly different way, in a slightly more unexpected way, I think. Somehow you find a way of bursting that tension, even if it's not... And you try and avoid the conventional route of a set-up punchline type thing. You know, you try and play with the tension in the room in a way that distinguishes... Not distinguish it, but is people laughing at unexpected moments. That, I think, is the distinction that you... The audience feels in some ways that they're being messed with, really. the whole thing's a bit of a rug pull. You know, you're pulling the rug from under them all the time. But I wouldn't say, you know, I mean, I'm not like a purist, in terms of what anti-comedy is. It appears... on the surface to be dreadful. I think that's the nice thing about it. So Tommy Cooper's magic on the surface appeared to be absolutely dreadful. You know, it appeared to be, you know, three bathroom ducks and a, you know, and somehow he would do a magic trick that didn't really work and sort of kept on falling apart. And that was where the humour lay, is in it. Everything going wrong for him and everything going,
unexcited. It's that clowning element of suffering.
Yeah, yeah. Like
we're seeing someone attempt to be a magician
and fail
and suffer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And is that applicable to what
you
do?
I think so. I like the idea that I'm standing there suffering just as much as the audience are.
Like one of those MC rules of like you, as a host, you should always be one drink behind the crowd. Ed Axel should always be suffering nearly as much as his audience.
It should be as boring to me as it is to them. I don't know. In terms of, you know, and you get into a rhythm sometimes with particular audiences. I would say it's the anti-comedy element is that the idea, you know, I try and explore ideas that nobody really cares about exploring, like the Cold War or, you know,
Spanish Armada.
Yeah,
I think of that as kind of a new bit. I can really imagine you looking at your hand and reading out the Spanish Armada.
And it's just sort of taking you, because sometimes good comedians will take you to a place you didn't expect to go. And in a sense, I mean, if I was observing observational comedians, one of the tricks of the trade is to take your audience to a place they weren't planning to go to and explore that place, you know. And one of the things that things like the Spanish Armada were, one of the ideas behind it, if there were indeed ideas behind it, one of the ideas behind it was that you were taking the audience to a place that they didn't want to go. Not only they didn't want to go, but you know they couldn't imagine ever wanting to go to. You know, so that was the logic of it, of those kind of that kind of thing. And I suppose the most of the stuff I do is about I like some of my shows. I like doing sort of exploring the meaning of life or the random nature of life or, you know, all of those things. And ultimately, I take the audience to a place that they weren't planning on going and, you know, given half the chance, would never go to ever. Anyway, that's the idea, at least.
I remember you often had a structure to your show which would be like either a corporate presentation, list of goals, you know, as almost as if you were reading or had read a manual on how to do show.
Yeah.
Seen through the prism of kind of a corporate structure. So these are my goals for the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, tactics, how am I gonna get there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so that would give you a structure from which to hang nothing, from which to hang your failure, your suffering.
Yeah. So, there were two things. There was some logic to that in some way, but the logic was that when you're planning a show, you have to do certain things. You know, you've got to open with a joke and then you've got to do a few more jokes, you know, settle the audience in for the first 20. Then you've got the middle 20, which is the hard bit to keep them, you know, all of shows have a structure. Every show has a structure. Why not just tell everybody what the structure is and how you're getting on within the structure? You know, so why not take, you know, as opposed to, you know, just make it as laborious as possible, but part of the trick of other acts' shows is everything that you're telling them you're going to do is in that show. It's just they're not going to tell you about it. You know, that's the smoke and mirrors. That's the bit that's kind of hidden. It's, you know, there's a funny thing that, you know, if you go and see a comedian, they do the same show twice. If you go and see them on two different nights. It's a structure. Every show, you know, is worked out on a blackboard in one form or another. It's a series of ideas, but done in a certain order and to mean a certain thing. And I thought it was a funny idea just to expose that and make it part of the amusement that this is a problem I've got to solve. I do a show, you know. And a lot of it was about when you say corporate, there was an element of I was also at the same time doing presentations to various people in a very dull way, which always started with an agenda and went through the points laboriously and ended with a thank you very much, thanks for coming, you know, type thing, you know. I was coming from a corporate place as well, I think.
And I remember seeing at the beginning of one of your shows a long time ago, was it Serge Gainsbourg or someone? You wore a scarf and glasses and you were singing.
That was Charles Aznavour.
Oh, Aznavour, of course it was, yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was Aznavour.
And I remember seeing in that particular bit, you were kind of singing along, but not well or out loud.
Yesterday
or,
when I was young.
Yes, kind of mumbling along almost with the song for quite some time.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing, like, I was delighted with that because I remember thinking, oh, right, this is... I felt like I was getting a bit of a way into the way your mind worked. I was like, oh, this is how he does it. What you do is you think of a thing that a performer's supposed to do and you attempt it badly and fail at it.
Yeah, yeah.
So rather than opening on a song, you're singing along to something that you're a bit quieter than anyway.
Yeah. So yes. There's an element that I'm playing the game of trying to be a performer.
Yes.
And the character in some way, so there's an element of sort of character comedy, the character is going through the ropes, you know. But I actually don't quite know why I did the Charles Aznavour song. I always used to love that song because it was so melodramatic. There was just something beautiful about Yesterday When I Was Young. It was sort of so melodramatic and sort of... It was a sort of slightly kitschy sort of 70s song where, you know, you'd watch it on Des O'Connor. He'd be on Des O'Connor Tonight and, you know, the next guest would be Petula Clark or Sacha Distel. And I just loved that... I really loved mocking it in some ways. I don't know. Anyway, there we are.
Well, why? What aspect of it?
Because it was a lovely song, really lovely song, beautifully written, and when done seriously is meant to touch a chord, touch an emotion, give you a certain emotional reaction. But if you somehow completely destabilize it, then it becomes very funny at the same time because it's stupid. You know, there's a fine line between something being stupid and being sort of tragic. You know, I don't know. With great actors, there's a distinction between them being great actors at any one moment in time and being very pompous sort of idiots.
Yes. Yes.
So I think that's what I was trying to plough in a very not obvious way, but in a very overt way, was the distinction, you know, just how ridiculous it all was to even ever think about.
Something I've noticed from interviewing some oddballs on this podcast, yeah, is
who've that you had?
Lots of oddballs.
Yeah, a lot of weirdos like me.
Lot of weirdos, none like you, lots of weirdos. Yeah, but something that they often have had in common is something to do with getting angry at the audience for not getting it. Sam Simmons, I remember.
Oh, really?
I really surprised me by saying that he was... I sort of, when you're doing this incredibly absurd stuff and they're not laughing, do you feel like you're failing? And I think he said words to the effect of, no, I'm angry with them because they're stupid that they can't get, you know, not that they're stupid, but I'm angry with them that they can't get it. And you mentioned that these days you're more...
I wouldn't say that. I'm not in the Sam Simmons. I still feel I failed. So I still feel I've completely... as I'm standing there, I still feel, if you're not laughing, I've failed.
And how does that feel? Because
that doesn't make me angry. It means it makes me feel inept.
Okay, you failed and you're inept. Is there an emotional weight attached to that? Do you feel bad? Does it ruin your day? Do you feel sad? Do you feel like you've... Because I think what I'm getting at is if I take the risks that you take and fail, I would want to kill myself. Do you know what I mean? I'd feel so negative and personally, like, I would feel awful for having failed.
Yeah, I mean...
Please don't now kill yourself. No, you see what I mean?
No, I wouldn't say... While you're on stage, there's a game in town, yeah? People aren't laughing. There's got to be a way to make them laugh. And I think that's possibly where Sam Simmons and I are a kind of on the same page, is if he's running around, people aren't laughing, he gets angry with them, he's trying to find a way to make them laugh. I do the same. I try and find a way. Whatever you can, make him laugh. Even if it's only once, just try and make him laugh. Find something that's going to make him laugh. But afterwards, I think that there is a genuine feeling of being inept. But different gigs play differently, you know. It's like Edinburgh, you know, you have one gig, you know, you pull the roof off, the following day you can't get arrested, you know. You know, I don't know, but it's a feeling of being inept, I think. I kind of accept the ineptness that I've got. I kind of know I'm a loser anyway. In some ways, it just reaffirms my original opinion of being a loser. Whereas when I do well, that's a surprise. It's the doing well that's the surprise. Genuinely doing well is the difference. You know, I feel better doing well, but if I do badly, what's new? You know,
that's I feel like there's an inherent kind of clown truth in that.
I am an idiot anyway, you know. It's funny, but I suppose that's the way I feel anyway. But there's less at stake now than there used to be, sort of performing stand up,
because.
Well, there's less money in it. There's less. It matters less. So I do a lot of sort of kind of castings, ads, that kind of thing, and sort of acting work, and that seems to be, in terms of the product, you know, in terms of just purely standing up on stage and making people laugh, that seems to be much more profitable these days, really. So I've done a couple of sitcoms this year. What, Lee and Dean? Have you heard of Lee and Dean? It's on Channel 4. I'm a character called Uncle Brian. And that's usually good because that's an improvised... So there's it's an improvised comedy, so... You know, you try and... each scene is unique and, you know, that's quite challenging. I did a bit of acting with John Cleese. I was in... Have you heard of Hold the Sunset?
No.
It's John Cleese, Alison Steadman, those kind of things. I did a scene with John Cleese earlier in the year.
Is this a sitcom or a movie?
A sitcom,
okay.
So... I was in The Crown earlier in the year.
You were in The Crown?
I know.
Did you play in The Crown?
I know. I was a Labour politician, George Brown.
Okay.
In the Harold Wilson beats him to the leadership of the Labour Party.
I'm sorry to hear that because I love the moments when I'm watching something I don't know that someone's going to be in.
Yeah,
bloody
yeah.
Bloody hell!
Yeah, yeah. I was in The Favourite of Yorgos Lanthimos.
No, I don't know that.
You not heard of Rachel Weisz?
I've heard of Rachel Weisz.
Olivia Colman. The Favourite's on, about to be released. It's quite, sort of a big, classy film. Very small part in that.
Okay.
But that's kind of what I do these days. And that I like that because it's different. It's, you know, you've got to catch a moment. You know, you've got, the performance is unique. You know? With castings, it's you know, you've got to be a bank manager, you know, jumping off, you know, the Eiffel Tower 5 minutes with one leg in the air. It's unique. You've got unique moments and you've got to create them at that moment in time. I like that because that is distinct from stand-up, which becomes formulaic, I think. And finding a way out of that formulaic. Finding a way out of being a one-trick pony, I think, is the big thing. I was very interested in what Luke's trying to do, because I think he tried to move away from what he was and become something else.
Mm.
I'd like to do that, certainly on stage, but it's very difficult because the world is full of weird now. So it's very difficult to either maintain what you've already got, but if you don't maintain what you've already got, are you going to be distinct from anybody else? I think one way or another, I'm always going to be unique. You know, I don't think there's any way around that.
I wonder if in a casting context, you have the superpower of having been in very awkward rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and there's a great advantage about the sort of rhino hide of very awkward situations. Used to being in very awkward situations with a bunch of awkward people who don't want to really be there. you know, in a pub, sort of a, you know, on a Friday night in, you know, North London somewhere, and there's seven people and they're all staring at you going, I really don't want to see you. You know, I've done all those awkward, I'm good at awkward situations, yeah. Very good.
And that presumably means in a casting situation, which I imagine can get very awkward, as you try to be a businessman jumping off the Eiffel Tower in front of three people who are variously interested or not.
Actually being
able to have that rhino hide.
Yeah.
And just to keep doing the work as it occurs to you.
Despite
the kind of potentially horrendous situation. You should be teaching an acting class there. You should be teaching a casting class.
I feel no embarrassment. Yeah, I feel, I, I, you know, Can do all of these situations without really thinking about it. Yeah. I love them because they are so random, you know. And I like the idea of acting. I mean, acting is distinct from stand-up in the sense that, you know, you are told to do something that is very, very specific. You know, you're told to be a Russian aristocrat at the turn of the century, and that is what they want. Can you do it? And there is a challenge in bending every sinew and nerve to be that, as opposed to the stand-up, where it's almost the world comes to you. Maybe the world shouldn't come to... Maybe I'd be doing it wrong, but the world shouldn't come... But the world almost comes to you, and people come and see you. I mean, Stuart Lee had this great, great line and this great joke where someone's saying, I saw you tonight, I paid £10 for the ticket and I thought you were shit. And Stuart says, well, you bought us a ticket tonight to see Stuart Lee, yeah? He says, yes. Well, I am Stuart Lee. That's it. That's all I am. You came to see me, you think I'm shit, fine. But I am Stuart Lee. That's it. You know, so, yeah, maybe that's the distinction between acting and stand-up. I don't know. Who knows? Who knows? Who knows? So, but that's... The variation I like, because that's, you know, the acting brings and the casting brings, is because it's, you know, I've got a casting this afternoon and, you know, it's just the variation that I like, you know, come up with something and deliver it and then walk away. It goes badly. This is the thing is that I've had years of stuff going really, really badly in front of people. If it goes badly... What's changed, you know? But sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you nail it and you get the part and you're in the crown.
I do wonder whether in your future there is a Dave Johns style getting the right opportunity with the right director. And then, although in his case, obviously Dave was able to become famous for the movie and then tour his stand-up show because he does regular stand-up and he could talk about the experience of auditioning and being in the movie.
Yeah.
I wonder if you become a massive movie star in a Mike Leigh film, would you want to then tour Ed Axel as Ed Axel currently does stand-up?
Yeah, I would. I would like to do that. It depends. I like acting. I like, you know, I like that world. And funnily enough, it's a bigger world than stand-up. Stand-up's quite a small world in some ways. I find stand-up, although having said that, I've probably only inhabited quite small areas of stand-up, but in some ways stand-up is there's a limit to what you can do to get on television or panel shows. That world is actually in itself quite small. Whereas acting, there's a kind of... The world is much bigger.
Do you feel like a success?
No. Good God, no. I'm a failure. Throughout whatever I do throughout my life, I will always be a failure. There's no two ways about it. One way or another, I'll find an angle to tell myself, whatever I'm done, I'm a loser.
Are you happy?
No. Good. Well, yes. I'm actually very contented. I've taken this year off Edinburgh and I've sort of taken my foot off the pedal of the last year or so, and I've been much happier doing that. Actually, gigging less. I get very tired of the travelling. Was travelling and anxiety. Funnily enough, I got quite OCD about before I went on stage, I'd always make sure I had, you know, my watch on, you know, you know, bits of paper and, you know, arrive. I don't miss that anxiety. I don't miss that level of anxiety, constant anxiety. Do you find that you have anxiety sometimes? But buried anxiety. If it's like a five, if you're on stage 5 nights a week, there's a level of anxiety that you carry around.
Absolutely.
That you can't explain, and you know you can't rationalise it. It is just there. There's just this knowledge of, you know, 200 people being a bit nasty.
So that was Ed. Now, listen, you might have heard us mention there, and I will certainly mention now in the spirit of fessing this up. I was supposed to put this one out earlier because tonight, the day I'm recording this, Monday, the 21st of January, Ed is at the Bill Murray doing his show, Ed Axel is Infinite. And I have lunched out and cocked up and failed to get this episode out in time. I made a note of it, but it wasn't in the main place I keep all my notes. Ed, I can only apologise. I hope lots of people went to your show. I punted it on the Facebook group, and I'm sure it sold very well. Many, many apologies for not getting this out when I said I would. I am sorry. I will try to do better in future. So please, if you've enjoyed this episode, you can see Ed's stuff on YouTube, but do try and get him live, because it is just such an extraordinary experience. I'm such a fan of Ed's work, and enormously apologetic and grovelling that I didn't manage to get this out a week or two sooner when I said that I would. Mea culpa. I've never said that before. Is that how you pronounce it? If not, I'm sorry. So thanks to Ed, thank you to Peter Dobbing, podcast consultant Nathan Wood, for the editing and uploading of the show. Thank you to Acast for hosting the show, and thank you to, who else? Rob Smouten for the music. Oh, I keep wanting to say something exciting about Rob, but I'm going to wait until it's officially announced. That is that. I've got a quick chat with you about an injury and a couple of gigs. But yes, I mentioned the Edinburgh Festival. You know I'm taking a year off this year. And you know, last week I was agonising over whether it would be a sensible thing to do on my year off would be to go to Edinburgh. I might be doing it. I'm about a day away from just confirming it. I wish to check with my excellent wife that she is happy for me to go to Edinburgh and completely absorb myself in that festival again while she parents both of our children solo and we work out a way to move forward on that together. I feel like it's probably good for the mental health of our family, if by which I mean me, if that happens. I just need to just dot the I's and cross the T's, and hopefully that will go ahead. Oh, I'd be so excited. I'm clearly excited about it. It's definitely a good thing to do, but, you know, responsibilities, and also the sort of magical year off thing, right? It's no good turning up there day one thinking, oh God, this again, when you've just done 25 in a row, right? That's nuts. Anyway, lots of stuff to report back on soon. That is that. Coming up next week, who have we got? Ooh, it's going to be Jake or Kay Trevor or Jess or Eggsy or Toby. I won't have done police cops by then. A couple of other people coming up soon. Some absolute belters in the can. Thank you for all of your positive feedback at ComComPod on all the socials and email info@comedianscomedian.com. Remember, you can get extra material from comedianscomedian.com/insiders and find out some behind-the-scenes-y gossipy stuff as me and Ed chat about our experiences on the Dr. Brown Clown Course. That's all for now. Speak to you soon. And if you want to hang around, a little post-amble. But for now, that concludes the podcast. So just two quick things. I had such a great time in Lyme Regis. I made a tactical error. I went to the Marine Theatre in Lyme Regis, which was not the error. The theatre was fantastic. A brilliant gig down there for fabulous comedian, compere, and gig promoter Tom Glover, who I'm afraid to say I can't remember the name of the organisation, the night that he runs, but I believe that's his main one, is the Marine Theatre in Lyme Regis, which I would recommend to anyone. What a room, what lovely people. And proper like a nice theatre with a bit of a lip on it, on the stage, a bit of, is that called an apron? Who knows? And that kind of like plaster of Paris painted gold in swirls up the side, like, you know, like proper, like a theatre. And I had a wonderful, wonderful show there. Worked with Sandy Smith, who was very funny, Tom himself, and Dan Evans, who you will remember from episode 2 of this podcast some 6 or 7 years ago, who just continues to churn out some of them. Churn out. Unthinking and uncaring. He churns out absolutely superb jokes. So great to see them. I was thinking of trying to add that venue to my tour before I went there. And then I went there and I suspect it was rammed. And I feel like I've already done a big chunk of the show to everyone in Lyme Regis that's interested in comedy. So it might need to wait until the autumn bit, but we'll see. So thank you to everyone that came to that. Big shout out to Kate Duncan and also to Andy, name I can't remember, who said hello afterwards. But thank you for coming along and thanks for sticking around to say hi. And also to Denzel, who popped in with a bunch of mates. So that's that. All I wanted to talk to you about, and very quickly, because there's so much on as the year ramps back up, I just wanted to briefly mention an injury that I had. I flipped between feeling old and not very old. As soon as you get a little bit old, it's very easy when you're a bit neurotic to start feeling old, like it becomes a thing. My mum does this. I'm sure she thinks she's much older than she is, but I'm absolutely doing this myself. I feel old and then I go, oh, I feel a bit old. And then it just becomes this narrative, you know, it's this sort of constant anxiety that's in the background. That's another thing. Every time I notice one, I'm like, oh, great, I'm going to be worried about that for the rest of my life. Anyway, I have been feeling, I've got this weird impacted, this is, what's this called? A friend of mine calls this the organ recital, when elderly people meet and start listing what's wrong with their bodies. But this is a very specific point. I've done something to my knee, possibly from carrying my two children for long distances. But it's not an injury, it just feels really... It's, you know, in a bruise when it kind of feels all bulgy and you're like, oh, that it feels, you know, if you ever lift a weight and afterwards you go, God, all the blood's in that muscle there, it feels enormous and it looks enormous to you. I've got that with my knee. That's weird, isn't it? So I had that. I had a bit of a twinge in my shoulder. And then yesterday I had this, like, I moved, I was washing up and suddenly I went, ugh, and kind of like my pelvis gave out and I thought, God, I'm so old. And then throughout the day, as I minded about feeling old and broken, I suddenly realised, oh no, I've pulled a specific muscle, like a deep, deep muscle in my lower back. I've pulled a muscle. So that's what it is. It's not that I'm falling apart. It's not that my body is an awful catalogue of errors. But it's a specific thing. So that's fine. No need to feel old. And then I realised I couldn't remember when I pulled it and I felt old again. And then I remembered, oh, I've remembered, fine, I'm not old. And then I remembered it was when I slightly fell down the stairs, which is the sort of thing a very elderly stew would do. So I flipped very quickly from feeling like I'm old. Oh, no, I'm young. No, I am old. Now I am young. Oh, God, I'm old. So that's how I'm feeling at the moment. And I'm only buoyed up by coffee. What a tiny, tragic anecdote. It'll have to do for now. Too much to do. Love you. Speak to you soon. Who's coming next? Have we decided? I had such a great chat with Eggsy from Goldie Looking Chain. And I love them. Maybe we'll chuck Eggsy out next. And then Jess Fostercue. Look out for Jess's excellent podcast, Hoovering. I guested on that one. She guested on this one. And we had a really fun time. And I also yawned in her face in a barely disguised way several times, because it had been a few mornings on the trot of getting up at 5 with the Baba. And she also has a child and was very politely ignoring my huge yawns, which I hope Nathan can edit out of that one. But it was a fascinating show. It was a great interview. She's excellent. I just was yawning and so tired. Okay, enough on that. Speak to you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics, all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.